Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your guest host, and as always, you're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. I am Bob Schlaber, sitting in today for regular host Eugene Perrier as he is out celebrating his birthday week. Today we're talking about the latest revelations between President Trump's administration and the Russian government, the discovery that Mike Pence may have his own email problems in Indiana, and a bizarre arrest of the person behind the Jewish bomb threats across the country over the past weeks. But before we can move on, we have undoubtedly slipped further into the absurd in relation to the continued political and media fury around claims that Donald Trump's presidential campaign had a nefarious or sinister relationship with the Russian government officials. President Trump today got the most recent laugh, tweeting out a picture of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer having a donut along with Russian President Vladimir Putin in 2003. Trump highlighting here that U.S. officials regularly meet with top-ranking officials from other countries. This after his own Attorney General Jeff Sessions came under fire yesterday for having met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak last fall. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has since recused himself from further investigation of Russia's relationship with Donald Trump's campaign after a firestorm of criticism following revelations about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. Sessions came under criticism because he had stated in his confirmation hearing he had no contacts with the Russian government. Democrats were quick to jump on this and demand both Sessions' resignation for apparently lying under oath and for a deepening of the investigation into Russia and its alleged role in the 2016 election. Sessions emerged in the afternoon press conference to state that he had consulted with Justice Department legal counsel and decided to recuse himself from the investigation into Russia's alleged role in the elections. He also noted during the question and answer this was despite the fact the White House did not believe he needed to recuse himself. The story was also quickly followed by revelations that another top Trump advisor, Jared Kushner, also met with the Russian ambassador, along with former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, shortly after the election in a previously undisclosed meeting. All of this has rekindled the firestorm over the Trump administration's alleged relationship with Russia, which at this stage in the game is openly turned into the theater of the absurd. Sessions' meeting with the Russian ambassador are clearly of the type most politicians have on a regular basis. In fact, as pointed out in the New York Times article about the Russian ambassador, it was not unusual for all sorts of senior officials to attend events and dinners there. This is the essence of diplomacy. All diplomats try to meet and talk to people in their host country to build relationships and hopefully build understanding of the way the country views things. The Russian ambassador seems to have been doing this with what every other ambassador does, maintain contacts with a variety of American citizens and officials. Again, everyone does this. Just like, as we pointed on the show, dozens of other nations spend large monies on lobbyists and think tanks and the like to also try to influence U.S. policy. This is not strange or nefarious, really. It's also what U.S. diplomats do in countries around the world where they maintain vigorous outreach to varying parts of civil society. Sessions met with the ambassador apparently two times, once after a speech at some gathering at the RNC, and basically anyone who has ever given a presentation knows that people just come up and talk to you. And the other was in his office with the ambassador and requested a meeting. Sessions is a senior senator on several committees, so it makes sense that any ambassador may want to have a relationship with someone like that, given their job. Sessions alleges that 25 ambassadors sought him out for similar types of meetings over that same time period. Ultimately, the day-to-day coverage of the story has become completely absurd. But the only thing that seems fairly clear is now the innocuous things are being leaked, along with thinly sourced claims from the intelligence community to preempt any real investigation and force Trump to remove certain advisors and box him in on Russian policy. There are plenty of reasons for Trump to be criticized in Sessions too, but if the criticisms and attacks are basically evidence-free and serve to only ratchet up tensions with the nuclear power, reify the intelligence community, and replace them with run-of-the-mill neocons, that doesn't seem worth the effort. Two inmates are dead in Tecumseh State Correctional Institute in Nebraska. Prisoners had risen up against the guards in revolt and set fire in the courtyard. This is the same prison where a similar situation took place, and again, inmates died in 2015. In that case, inmates appeared to have been trying to air grievances they had with the prison and how it was run. This, of course, follows on the heels of the Delaware prison uprising recently that was centered around the demands of prisoners for recognition of their human rights. It also reflects the broader trend starting in 2008 of prison uprisings and strikes across the country. Prisoners have been fairly rebellious and active in raising the issues of their confinement. As we've constantly reported on this show, American prisoners are significantly overcrowded, understaffed, provide extremely poor health care and food, and are often filled with those convicted of crime for which either the imprisonment itself or the length are unnecessarily cruel. When you put it all together, we've got quite a powder keg, both for the prisoners and the guards. went off again in Nebraska this week, but until we address seriously mass incarceration in this country, it absolutely won't be the last time. Reuters has obtained sources that have helped further flesh out what the EPA would look like under Donald Trump. The administration hopes to cut the agency's budget by 25% to $6.1 billion and staffing by 20% to 12,400 employees. The savings will then allegedly be transferred to the Pentagon to help pay for Donald Trump's proposed $54 million increased spending on the military. Some of the specifics we learned last night include a 30% cut to programs that help states fund lead cleanups, 30% cut to grants to Native nations to combat pollution, a 70% cut to one program focusing on reducing methane emissions and greenhouse gases, and another 42% cut in brownfield industrial site cleanup. There's another 11% reduction of money for the enforcement of environmental regulations as well. These are massive changes, and they're being proposed at a time that, according to the New York Times, Steve Bannon and Ivanka Trump are locking horns over the Paris Climate Agreement. Bannon wants the U.S. to withdraw. Ivanka believes they should not withdraw and have been joined in their views by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Either way, it seems clear that the White House's budget, similar to Ronald Reagan's first budget, is attempting to reduce the EPA to obsolete bare bones allowed based on the required regulatory authority. However, many in Congress, including Republicans, are supportive of many of those programs, so it's unclear how the battle on the Hill, or even apparently within the White House, will play out. Although it seems like the ultimate outcome won't leave more than a glimmer of hope for those demanding climate justice. And those are today's talking points. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your guest host, Bob Schlehuber. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
We are joined in studio to continue this conversation with Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW here in Washington, D.C., along with Jamal Muhammad, a.k.a. DJ One Love, host of The Love Lounge on We Act Radio. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Garland, let's stick here with the news everyone is running full speed with again today, and that is the relationship between Donald Trump's administration, or alleged relationship between Donald Trump's administration and campaign, and that of the Russian government. What do you make of the most recent news that Jeff Sessions had met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the presidential campaign?
A couple of things. Look, I think it is reasonable to have an issue with any person who goes before Congress, particularly during a confirmation hearing, and misleads members of Congress, or says something that's patently false, which it certainly appears that Jeff Sessions did. So, you know, I think from that perspective, I agree that there's a problem there, and that particularly being the AG, there should be some concern.
But what Sessions is arguing is they asked him from the campaign perspective, mm-hmm. you as a surrogate on the campaign, did you meet with the Russian government officials, which he said no. If what he's saying is that, no, you know what, when I was a U.S. senator on the Armed Foreign Service Committee, I met mm-hmm. with the Russian ambassador, but that's not what Senator Al Franken had asked, and so that's what he's pushing back on. Do you think that kind of nuance within the face of the law is going to work for him, or do you think the Democrats do have a case that he perjured himself?
You know, I think it depends on the details. Here's what I think. I think at minimum, I think it is not unreasonable to say, There is enough here to say, let's look at what was said and how it was said. And I think based on the way it was said, it can be, you know, we can kind of iron out whether or not he actually perjured himself. You know, that's a high bar. A lot of times it certainly appears to me that he has a reasonable argument. You know, to perjury, before you're going to get a conviction on perjury, it has to be clear. And based on what I've heard right now, I think it's going to be very difficult to actually say, argue that he perjured himself. That being said, the issue that I have here is that this is just another manifestation of the anti-Russian argument, of the argument that basically says this: Hillary Clinton did not lose, the Russians robbed her. It was the Russians came in and they stole it from her. And that this argument is manifesting itself in every facet of the news, in every attack on the Trump administration. I'm no fan of the Trump administration, but I'm certainly not a fan of the new Cold War argument that's trying to protect Hillary from culpability for losing to Donald Trump and for creating an environment in which Donald Trump could easily win against the Democrats.
And I mean, why can't the Clinton and the Democrats just say, you know, we lost, we need to regroup, we need to re-strategize, we need to redevelop policy? Why such a doubling down on the fact that we had three million more populist votes? Why is that narrative so important to them?
Yeah, okay. And to me, that's an easy win. Here's why. Because Hillary Clinton didn't just lose. the policies of the neoliberals lost, the policies of her third way. You know, you can go whatever it is, thirdway.org. Her people who have been arguing for a long time that the Democratic Party needs to move to the right, that they need to be conservatism light. Remember, Chuck Schumer said, for every Democrat that we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we'll pick up two Republicans in, you know, in the suburbs of Philly and Wisconsin, Michigan. They were arguing to move their policy was clearly to move the party to the right. That policy and philosophy lost, and they cannot accept that, because if they do, they're also going to have to accept the fact that it was corporatism and it was the ownership of the party by Wall Street that had a big party in a play in that. And now they got to discuss whether or not they're going to stop taking money from Wall Street, which ain't happening.
Jamal Muhammad joining us, DJ One Love. How long can the Democrats or people who are anti-Trump run with this Russian Trump campaign narrative? The Democrats have been vocal on this issue since last June, when it was first reported the DNC emails have been leaked. After 9 months, I'm not quite sure what the Democrats have to show for it, except the resignation of National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, which probably would have come eventually down the line given something or another, given Mike Flynn's love of conspiracy theories. And major political losses, though, for the Democrats. How long can they continue this argument, and is it a winning effort at the end of the day?
You know, the funny thing about all of this is that if we just be patient, we're going to see this whole thing implode, is from what I'm seeing, because we're barely a month into this administration, and we've already had Flynn resign, and now we're dealing with this situation with Sessions, we're dealing with DeVos. I mean, there's so many hiccups and so many just flops going on already that I'm observing this whole. You know, I posted something yesterday. I said that Wrinkley Brothers didn't retire. They just renamed themselves the Trump administration. If for the Democrats, you know, you got to run with this. You have to, because you lost. And as far as the losing, as far as I'm concerned, I think they grossly underestimated America as a whole. And they grossly underestimated that there is a portion of America that has felt disrespected for the last 8 years for whatever reasons. You know, most of it has to do with the Obama administration, but they have to run with this, because this is the only anchor they have right now to hold themselves, you know, being the minority leaders. But all I'm saying is just keep watching. It's a fiasco going on right now. And it's actually embarrassing as an American, because, you know, all of a sudden, you know, with Trump's running, all of a sudden, this is reemergence of the Russians, and, you know, and whether it be on the Democratic side of saying them, you know, hacking and involving in the election, or it being on the Republican side with Trump. And we're now seeing that several other people of his administration also met with the Russian ambassador as well.
But Jamal, I guess I'm on two minds on this. On one end, yes, there's continued daily allegations around the Trump and Russia allegations, but over time and time again, it shows at the end of the day, there's no direct relationship or cooperation or some nefarious plan between the two sides. I guess, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe for you, Garland, at what point does this anchor issue that they keep bringing back up turn into a Benghazi-esque situation where they're just running around trying to create the conspiracy theory, trying to link people together as opposed to focusing on policies? At what point does this anchor conversation that is gaining traction in the media actually hurt the party, as nobody feels like they're being spoken to except this kind of elitist bubble on the East Coast yelling about Russia and the United States, when people are saying, hey, we don't have jobs, we're not getting our basic criminal justice reform that we called for? Doesn't this eventually hurt them by coming back to this argument every day?
It does. And see, you know, Jamal brings up a good point, and I want to run off that. He said, well, you can just sit back and wait for the Trump administration. I mean, you know, the stellar level of incompetence in the Trump administration, clearly they're going to they're going to fold. However, my position is this. The Russia argument is not related to the Trump administration. You know, whenever you have a party has to do two things. They got to, of course, you know, they've got to attack the opposite party, but they also have to deal with the consolidation of strength within their own party. And I think the whole Russia argument is about the Democratic Party dealing with the internal issues that they have. And that is, they've got a very large element of their party that's unhappy with the leadership. that's unhappy and does not trust the power structure. And so they have to deal with them. And I think one of the ways they're dealing with them is, or one of the ways they're attempting to deal with them, and they're attempting to fend off the people who are saying, you screwed up and you made errors and you gave us Trump, is by deflecting and saying, well, we lost because of, you know, something that was out of our, we were done wrong. Now, here's the thing that I find interesting. You know, I've been tweeting out this picture. 1996, there was a cover of Time when Boris Yeltsin won in Russia. And the cover of the Time said, Yanks to the rescue. And it there was an article in there that detailed how four American operatives went to Russia and helped Boris Yeltsin win. So the United States in 1996, and who was president then? Bill Clinton. In 1996, on the cover of Time, there was an article in which the United States bragged about how they interfered in the Russian election.
Garland, that was America doing that abroad. That's okay if the United States goes abroad and does it if it's done.
But now they make dubious claims, unsupported claims about the Russians, and now it's the end of the world.
And Jamal, to come back to what you're saying, I think there's something definitely to be said for obstructionism. I mean, if Hillary Clinton was elected to become president, I can guarantee you the Republicans every day would have been brought up the Podesta group's relationship with Russia and the fact that his group did take money directly, which is on record. It would have brought up Clinton's ongoing email scandal, which would have been news every single day. So I guess maybe the argument could be made about being obstructionist, but isn't it a little dangerous to be an obstructionist with details around Russia, another nuclear power, and having no evidence to it? Can you almost hurt yourself by being an obstructionist and needing to focus elsewhere?
Well, you absolutely can, but if they do this right, you use it as leverage and don't run it into the ground where that's the only horse that you're beating, but use it as leverage to confront all the other agendas that they're trying to address. I mean, right now, you know, they need to be focusing on the fact that they're repealing the ban on privatized prisons and getting back to that. They need to be talking about the current situation with funding private education, all these different issues that they need to be fighting with. But they do need to attack this situation, because if anything, it hurts what the Trump administration has been promising, because right now there's no answer for Obamacare. There's still no answer to building that wall. There's still no, you know, the revising the travel ban, all these things that Trump had promised immediately he can't implement. And so it's kind of like, you know, beat somebody down when they're wounded. You take advantage of them. Don't take your foot off the neck until they're done.
I hear you, but I think also concern of the Democrats chasing this is they're going to embarrass themselves. I mean, Donald Trump got a huge laugh today by tweeting out this picture of President Putin. And then same with Claire McCaskill. The senator from Missouri, was so excited yesterday to go at Jeff Sessions. She had tweeted out, I've been on the Armed Services Committee for 10 years. No call or meeting with Russian ambassador ever. Ambassadors call members of the Foreign Relations Committee. Journalists went out, took a closer look at Mrs. McCaskill's Twitter feed, and it revealed in several incidences in 2013 and 2015, she had written about going to meet with the Russian ambassador. So it's like, what a joke that this woman is saying that we're going to take the high ground, we're going to be obstructionists, we're going to hit Trump on Russia and all these other issues, but here they are themselves also doing the same stuff accusing Trump.
That's the danger of non-substantive attacks. You got a guy that's giving you everything in the world to attack, and you go with a non-substantive attack. So what you have to ask yourself is, if they're in a target-rich environment, why would they go in the other room and shoot at someone else? Because their attacks are totally unrelated to Donald Trump. Their attacks are all about preserving the policies of the rejected policies of the establishment Democratic. And the attacks that they're fending off are the attacks from the left, from Bernie and Keith Ellison and people like Garland Nixon here.
Let's talk more about that after the break. We are with Garland Nixon and Jamal Muhammad for the hour. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your guest host, Bob Schlehuber, filling in for Eugene Pereira today. As always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
Well, Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your guest host, Bob Schlehuber, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Today, we're talking about the ongoing investigation into the relationship or alleged relationship between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russian government, and whether or not the Democrats have a winnable strategy heading down this path. We are joined in studio to continue our conversation with Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW and show favorite here, and Jamal Muhammad, a.k.a. DJ One Love, host of The Love Lounge on We Act Radio. Jumping right back into it, it was reported last night by the Indianapolis Star that Vice President Mike Pence used a personal email account for official Indiana business while governor, and that account was hacked by a low-level scammer last summer. Now, as many people remember, Vice President Pence was a harsh critic of Hillary Clinton during the presidential campaign for using a private email account during her time as Secretary of State. Pence used a personal AOL account to correspond with top advisors in Indiana, at a time discussing sensitive topics that included the state's response to terror attacks and the arrest of several men on federal terror-related charges. According to emails released to the Star in response to public records requests, Garland, as many people are calling for Donald Trump to be impeached or to be replaced, Mike Pence is next in line, followed by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Are you surprised by this recent discovery that Mike Pence would have his own email server? And people aren't bringing as much attention to Mike Pence today around this scandal as they did with Hillary Clinton's own emails.
A couple of things. I'm not surprised because, you know, people who have been around government as long as I have known that this is not as uncommon as people. And that is to have an email. Now, my understanding, if Pence had an email account. Right. But not a server. See, a big part of the discussion with Hillary, with Secretary Clinton and some other people that were compared to her was, did you have an account? You know, there's a difference between me having a Gmail account and me building a server in my house. So I'm not saying this to defend Mike Pence. I'm saying that it's not, you know, it's certainly not apples and oranges, but it's irresponsible. And I think that it's something that has been all too common, and hopefully having had it brought out here will decrease some of this. Because for the most part, the reason this is done is so that people won't know what the particular politician is doing. That when they come and subpoena your state or your federal emails, you'll have them on another, you know, a Gmail account or a Hotmail account, whatever the case may be, and they won't be able to get them. So hopefully this brings it out enough in the open that a whole bunch of politicians that are doing it right now will close those accounts down.
In Jamal, I mean, obviously, again, as Garland saying, it's not illegal to have another email account as a public official, and often people maintain separate email accounts just to be able to separate their personal and professional life. Obviously, Mike Pence slid in his professional work into his personal email and eventually got hacked and spammed, and contacts from his email were spread out there. But it ultimately does seem comparable in the sense that you have elite officials that are fine with going outside the rules or kind of finding the ambiguous ways to go about to be able to do what they want. Jamal, is this not why people in America are so fed up with both the Democrats and Republicans, and ultimately why 93 million people stayed home this last election because of actions like this?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's bad optics. I mean, and that's just the bottom line. It's getting to the point where it's like, well, who can we trust from either party? You know, now, of course, the situation with Pence, this was when he was governor, and this wasn't a federal issue, but it was still an issue of trust. And because you keep saying, well, why, you know, if you're a governor or you're a secretary of state or anyone in the high seats of politics, why are we having this issue with something as simple as emails and having the protection of emails when we're like the most powerful nation in the world, and yet we can't protect simple emails? And I think it's just the trust in our government is eroding. And this is why you have so many people that are not voting anymore, not trusting it anymore, because while the Democrats and Republicans are going tit for tat and back, and, you know, it's like a volley here going on and on. The people are like, you know, we just want to be able to take care of ourselves. We want to have a job. We want to have a roof over our head. We want to be able to take care of our bills. We want to be able to be taken care of if we get sick. And we want to make sure that nobody blows us up. Meanwhile, you guys are sitting here playing, you know, playing badminton with each other with our lives.
Yeah, go ahead, Garland.
Let me throw this out here, too. Don't be misled. I don't think that Hillary Clinton or anyone else lost because they have a separate email. Let me give you an example. You know, I was could be considered an appointed official in the Ehrlich administration, and I still had a Yahoo account. Right now, Bob, one of the local states, you know, a state that you live in said, you know, their senator passed away and they said, Bob, we're going to make you a senator. Would you give up your Hotmail or your Yahoo account? No. So the fact of the matter is that people are going to have an account. Now, when it is used for nefarious purposes, that's a whole nother thing. But I think it's legitimate to discuss this thing. But I think we get a little carried away if we start thinking that politicians are actually losing or winning based on these things. I think there's a whole lot more to it.
Point is that if those DNC leaks came out and it talked about how excited they were to have Bernie Sanders in the race, to hear from a wider range of Democrats in the Big Ten, if it talked about hiring U.S. ambassadors based on merit and not who had given the most donations, if it talked about having to make sure you fought the entire Republican Party as opposed to pushing Donald
Trump.
And
if we
to the
found
top,
out that everything that Hillary Clinton had said during the debates was the exact same things that she told to the people, the bank owners behind the scenes.
And I think it also speaks, in going back to kind of some more of this Russian leak stuff, it speaks too of who these politicians trust. It's reported today that the Democrats and Republicans are considering reaching out to Christopher Steele. Our listeners will remember Christopher Steele is the former MI6 spy who prepared the unsubstantiated dossier on Donald Trump, which got leaked to BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed reported, even though they could find no sources to back it up, there was no actual information. Well, Christopher Steele has been approached about testifying before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into the new president's alleged links with Russia. And so it's saying, Jamal, they're basically saying, well, everyday people out there, we hear you, but we don't have time for you. We're actually going to bring in this former spy person because we believe spies of other countries before we believe the everyday American citizen. How does that read to you, Jamal?
It's a numbers game that's going on right now. You have in 2017, you have a portion of America that doesn't trust it anymore, and then you have a portion of America that blindly trusts. And I think they're going with the portion that blindly trusts that, you know, what we say is true, even if we bring in someone that, you know. The spy game whole thing is because what we were talking about earlier is that we did the same thing to Russia, but you know, you have people in America that believe that it's okay if we do it and it's not okay if somebody else does it. As far as I'm concerned, it's just dealing with the cards that you're dealt with, and it's about how many people can we get to believe us, regardless of, you know, it's the elasticity that goes on when you make a decision, just like in raising the prices of bread in a grocery store. You know, a certain amount of people won't buy it, but a certain amount of people will continue to buy it. And is it worth it? I think that's just basically what it is. This is a number game.
And here's the other part. You know, I'm a big Bernie fan. If you listen to Bernie Sanders afterwards, while they were screaming about the Russians, the Martians, whoever, you know, stole it from them, Bernie was saying, we lost because we did not represent the values and the policies of the working class, the working poor, and the poor, the people who are suffering. While we're talking about the Russians, we're talking about email servers, the reason we lost is because, think about this, over 700 counties in the Rust Belt that voted for Obama voted for a flip to Trump. It wasn't because they woke up and joined the Klan. It was because we did not address the issues that they were concerned with. When a person can't, you know, here's what I think. We've gotten to a point where the standard of living for the working class has fallen to a level where they're not willing to actively participate in the political process anymore because they don't see anything in it for them. So if we talk about, you know, it's like we're talking about all these fluffy inside the beltway crappy issues and they can't pay their heating bill. What we have to do is we got to get to what Bernie's talking about, and that is let's talk about how people are going to pay their heating bill. Let's talk about how they're going to get a job. Let's talk about how they're going to pay for college. And then people will come and vote for you. They don't care about the Crimea. They don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah, and listening to that speech on Tuesday night, I'm sure there's plenty of people out there wishing that Hillary Clinton was the president and giving that speech. And I think ultimately the language that she would have used around the speech would have been different, and the verbiage would have been different, the rhetoric would have been different, it would have had a different feel to it. But at the end of the day, She was completely aligned with the wars in the Middle East. She was completely around economic interests for Wall Street and big bankers and the wealthiest of the wealthy. And I don't think she would have added much difference besides saying Black Lives Matter, but Blue Lives Matter as well. So you're not going to get your criminal justice reform that so many people on the streets are calling for, that it ultimately, at the end of the day, while it would have sounded differently, I don't think she would have offered the biggest, crucial, most divisive issues anything different than Donald Trump did when it comes to continuing those same policies. But I don't know, Jamal, what do you think about that?
Well, I totally agree, and that was always my problem with Hillary in the first place. The other issue is the fact that a lot of people did not trust Hillary. That's just plain and simple. On the election night, I was down there at Wake Forest University, and we were talking about it, with a lot of students. And it's a trust issue going here with America. A lot of the millennials are not falling for the same tactics. That's why I said it's a numbers game. But then at the same time, with the amount of people out there that just want to be able to wake up and know that they can go to work, know that if they get sick, they can be taken care of. They really don't care about, like he said, what's going on inside the Beltway. Because as far as they're concerned, they just want to know, am I going to eat today? Because you got parts of America that we don't hear about that have these soup kitchens and these long lines going out there, especially out in the Midwest. And I've been out there, that they're struggling, and they're like, hey, can I get a living wage that allows me to pay my bills and my child can go to college, or if my car breaks down, I can get it repaired. They don't care about the emails. They don't care about all this other garbage going on, this tit for tat that's going on. It's that percentage of people out there across America just want to be able to live. And live in harmony.
So where do we put that blame then? Because if the media is only covering Russia, the Democrats are only covering Russia, why not Garland Nixon? Why not speak to these issues? Why not try to address these issues? Why not drive this message and try to recapture these voters who are concerned about these? Why such the focus on the sensationalization of it all?
Here's the problem with the Democratic Party, and this is why they lost, and this is why they're in such trouble. Because the Democratic Party, you ask yourself, who is their base, right? You would say, well, a party responds to its base, right? They are responding to their base. Their base are not the voters. Their base are the wealthy donors. So what they're doing is they're protecting the wealthy donors. They can't very well say we lost because we just took a bunch of money from rich people and we ignored the working class and the working poor. They've got to defend the policy. They can't say we need to change our policies because their wealthy donors are going to freak out. A lot of the wealthy donors started flipping out when they thought that Keith Ellison was going to win. And there were some of the powerful people in the party that said, well, we were afraid the left was going to get control. They were afraid that the wealthy donors would lose control of the party. The bottom line is this. I believe the Democratic Party has gotten to a position where they don't care if they lose Congress. They don't care if they lose the state legislatures and governorships. The only thing they really wanted was the big prize, which was the presidency. Because if you have the presidency, then the big corporations can get anything they want. The president controls the bully pulpit, and he can steer policy towards directions where they can put all the money in the hands of corporations. And he can appoint all of the people who are going to give him that money. Well, but here's but at least I'll say this. The problem that the Democrats have is the big corporate donors have learned that they won with Trump because they're going to get the same thing with Donald Trump because they're going to get all the billionaires in charge. So why should they even support the Democrats from now on?
No, I mean, I hear you. And on the same issues around immigration and asking a similar question to you, Jamal, via updating our listeners on a story we brought you yesterday regarding Daniela Vargas. Ms. Vargas, a 22-year-old, was brought to the United States from Argentina when she was 7 years old. She had been attending the University of Southern Mississippi, but as an undocumented student was ineligible for aid and had to take a leave when the efforts by her and her parents to pay for her to attend school fell short. Over the time, her DACA status lapsed, which eventually led to her arrest on Wednesday. It is now being reported that Ms. Vargas will be deported back to Argentina without a court hearing. Jamal, this seems like a more powerful opportunity for the Democrats to seemingly pick on an issue to rally around, especially after the announcement by the Trump administration that the Department of Homeland Security will implement a guidance issued by the Trump administration that would create the Victims of Immigration Crime Enforcement Office, or as Donald Trump announced on Tuesday night, would be known as VOICE. This seems like another opportunity for Democrats to attack heavily against Homeland Security as they try to develop yet another new list, like your terrorist no-fly list, like your guns list, another list for them to target, surveil, terrorize, go after people, yet the Democrats have stayed rather quiet this week on this issue. Why?
I don't think they care that much, honestly. The whole immigration situation, that's another one that they should be addressing instead of this whole bull crap that's going on with Sessions. And they're not taking that route strong enough, as far as I'm concerned. America is divided right now on this. And once again, that's why I keep saying these numbers. You have a portion of America that's just like, okay, we want to be safe. And they associate safety with immigration and terrorism, regardless of what happens inside the borders from American-born citizens. That's what they associated with because of the fear-mongering that has been in place for the last, 16, 17 years almost. But they're not riding it hard enough, and they should be fighting it more, but they're not. And I don't know why, because, Bob, the numbers are in favor of people of color eventually being the majority of America. And you would think that they would be planning down the road, but I think it's because of what he just said. You know, they're basically kissing the butt of corporate America too much, and that's not a corporate American focal point.
Yeah, you know, Garland Nixon, I mean, cross-check, which was a way in which Kris Kobach, the GOP, was able to suppress voting by basically knocking people off of voter rolls in several states if their name appeared twice. The names were basically vetted by if the first and last names matched, as opposed to if the middle name and some type of surtitle matched as well. So for me, it seems like, why not take this effort to have the cross-check list along with the terrorist no-fly list, along with this new list that will be created by people calling into this voice system, and run with it? I mean, is it, again, I guess I'm going to ask you again, is it basically just saying we don't care about these people because they're not going to vote for us? Or is that too big thinking? And the Democratic politicians are just worried about making the news cycle for the day.
It's simple. They're not responding to the base of immigrants, people of color, working class or working poor. They're responding to the wealthy donor base.
Yeah.
And that don't cut it with them. They don't care about that.
No, I guess I keep on looking for a deeper explanation besides that to have faith in the political system.
Good luck finding
one. I'll continue to search. Let's take a break while I try to gather more of my thoughts. We'll be back after this with Garland Nixon and Jamal Muhammad. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your guest host, Bob Schlehuber, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Today, we're talking about the recent arrests and the bomb threats aimed at Jewish institutions across the country. George W. Bush, yes? We're going to talk about George W. Bush for whatever reason, and a little bit on Colin Kaepernick. We are joined in studio to continue our conversation with Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, and Jamal Muhammad, a.k.a. DJ One Love, host of The Love Lounge on We Act Radio. Check that out online, streaming live, along with Sputnik News Radio, which you also can listen to live. Thank you guys for staying with us and continuing our conversation. A man was accused of making at least 8 threats against Jewish community centers, Jewish schools, a Jewish museum, and the Anti-Defamation League, was arrested by the FBI in St. Louis, Missouri earlier this morning. Though the man is not to be believed to be the main suspect behind this year's rash of bomb threats, 2 law enforcement officials told ABC News. So the man was accused of at least 8 of these threats. The accused, Juan Thompson, is 31 years old and a former journalist for The Intercept until his firing in January 2016 over fabricated sources and quotes, is accused by what federal prosecutors call the campaign to harass and intimidate. He's charged in New York with cyberstalking a New York City woman by communicating threats in the woman's name. The Intercept released a statement today saying, in part, we're horrified to learn this morning that Juan Thompson, a former employee of The Intercept, has been arrested in connection with bomb threats against the ADL and multiple Jewish community centers, in addition to cyberstalking. These actions are heinous and should be fully investigated and prosecuted. We have no information about the charges against Thompson other than what is included in the criminal complaint. Garland, now the confusing thing here, at least, or the not-so-obvious rush-to-judgment issue here, is that while he seemingly disliked white people, Juan Thompson, the accused here, also had a strong disdain for Donald Trump. So what's your takeaway from learning that an anti-Trump person was behind these attacks when Trump was blamed for causing many of them, given all of the news media last week was saying Donald Trump is the direct cause of this? It turns out him calling for it or his language wasn't spurring on a supporter, but in whatever way actually led to a crazed man who was an anti-Trump supporter. So make sense of this for us.
Well, you know, I'll go back to the old, Freudian analogy. And that is, known for assigning sexual reference to everything. When asked about a cigar, and he said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And sometimes a crazy person is just a crazy person. A person who is mentally ill is just a person who's mentally ill. I think that, while the intelligentsia and academia will try to read all of these deep-seated meanings into this, I think we got a guy who's probably mentally ill, maybe freaked out over some woman and decided that he was either going to get his twisted revenge or whatever. And I think it's quite possible, but particularly, and here's what tells me that, because there is no continuity to the story. It's not like he hated Jews and he loved Trump or hated Trump and it all goes together. They all kind of mishmash in different directions, which tells me we're probably just looking at something of a person who was mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, and so much of this whole idea around fake news is you wonder how much of it's people purposely putting out fake news, but when there's a rush to get stuff to the media and get it out on a 24-hour news cycle, you're going to get things wrong over and over and over again with this rush to putting it out there. So as much as people are calling for fact-check and calling for correction to these fake news stories, quote-unquote, it also seems like we need to slow down and actually give some of these stories a second to play out for police to do their investigations to find the people behind it, as opposed to continuing to run with narratives, because that seems just as dangerous. Jamal, the other important side of the story, given stepping away from the accused and what this man was driven by or not driven by, I think what was telling was that the Muslim community had come to support or defend the Jewish community. Several Muslim communities had offered to patrol certain buildings and cemeteries in relation to Jewish beliefs, and others had played major roles in fundraising to fix the damages, most notably in Missouri, where a cemetery had several of its Jewish headstones broken and torn apart. Jamal, is this the hope for the left in America that individual groups begin to coalesce on their own, opposed to them coming together through the Democratic Party?
Well, first off, I think the accused is mentally ill. I'm not even going to say he might be. I think he is, yeah, based off of what I've read about him. It's all about him, and he could easily become a sociopath. So we got to address mental health in America. That's one of the primary issues I think that needs to be addressed with everything that's going on, because you're starting to see more and more people like this of all races that are having these issues come out, because mental health is not something that is at the forefront.
And to
so
say
I
it too,
to
I think
that out the way.
Yeah, and I think often just to emphasize that the number one cause of homelessness amongst individuals in this country is mental health issues, not drugs or crime,
right,
or whatever else. It's mental health issues, but nobody's ever going to talk about
and
that.
Let me add this. If the Democrats wanted to talk about something, they could certainly use this opportunity to discuss the fact that a week ago, the Republicans just changed the law that prevented mentally ill people from getting weapons.
Exactly.
So the only fortunate thing we have here is this mentally ill guy. He could have gotten his hands on weapons and gone to a Jewish center or wherever he chose, mm-hmm, and opened fire. And I think when you have something like that, this is an option. And I'm not saying to use it for political purposes. I'm simply saying the fact of the matter is that is a danger that was created by this legislation last week. And I think the Democratic Party should be bringing that up. If I was leading the Democratic Party, I'd be screaming on the top of the mountains. You see?
Don't hold your breath for that. Don't hold your breath yet.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Jamal, what about the thought here? Is it up to individual interest groups to coalesce and come together, or does the Democrat? Yeah.
As a Muslim myself, I was glad to see the different Muslim institutions coming to help and work with the Jewish community. And I actually thought it was heartwarming, because I thought it was so disheartening to see these graves being desecrated, regardless of any race or religion or social economic background. One of the things that is supposed to be sacred across humanity is a grave. And to see that this is what was being targeted, I was glad to see the Muslim community come and say, hey, look, wrong is wrong, and we want to help you in whatever way we can help you. And I think that it is optimistic for the future of different religions and races to come together as human beings to fight against injustice. So I thought it was a an excellent move on the part of the Muslim community to work with the Jewish community, in particular because historically it's always been told that Jews and Muslims don't get along, and that's not true. You have regions of people that don't get along, but I have plenty of Jewish people that I've associated and even friends for years that I've known that we've gotten along fine. But when you add in money and politics into it, that's a whole different story. And it's not the first time, because even on the reverse side, there's been plenty of Jewish organizations that have helped out the Muslims as well, through all the Muslim bashing since 9/11 and so forth. And you don't hear a lot about that either.
Garland, I was covering an event earlier this week, two protests happening one after the other. The first one was local D.C. organizers that were for climate justice or trying to speak out had set up a rally in front of the Wells Fargo bank right by the White House and calling for the city to divest from Wells Fargo as one of the main financiers of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Well, at the end of that, there was a call then just to walk a few blocks to the other side of the White House where they were doing a rally around trans rights, trans equality, mm-hmm. trans efforts for students. And it was one of these moments where I was like, wow, if these groups just find themselves, what do they need the Democratic Party for?
Exactly. And it's, unfortunately, because the party is not being the hub for all of these various groups, they're being forced to, to kind of come together in unity. I know I have, a friend who's putting something together here in the next week. And there's a big thing going on in New York for climate change. But, to some extent, I mean, you could argue that it's good because for so long, paradoxically, Donald Trump has created an environment where a lot of people who weren't going to hit the streets, who wouldn't protest, who would maybe tweet a little bit, a little bit of Facebook stuff, have gotten so outraged that there is certainly a movement afoot for people who are for progressive minded people and the like that wasn't there before Donald Trump. And I, can remember people in the civil rights movement saying to me many times, be thankful for the extremists because they drive the middle towards you.
Jamal, have the large Occupy Wall Street movement. We have large protests over the last years around the Black Lives Matter movement. You see more and more people out there protesting, but yet the Republicans won the White House. They won Congress. They have complete control of 32 states with supermajorities across the board. Do these progressive social actions and protests equal anything after this last year, or the Republican Party, are they more than happy that people are going to run around and protest outside of the White House and it's not going to lead to anything?
No, they absolutely, they do make an impact. They do make a difference. It's, in this circumstance, once again, I would say the Democratic Party just grossly underestimated how upset a lot of white America was at what has happened, because once again, the numbers game, there's a large portion of America that felt that they were being ignored. And Trump, he appeased to that demographic. And once again, the Democratic Party, and in particular Clinton's administration or party group, they didn't address them. They ignored them. They underestimated how powerful and the numbers were with that group. So I don't think it has anything to do with the rise of protesting and the rise of activism that has occurred, because on other levels, we have seen a lot of difference. And in particular, me and Eugene have marched together and been at plenty of different rallies and spoken. You're seeing more and more people come out that did not even care about politics or care about legislation or anything. They just, especially on the liberal side, they just really wanted to enjoy life. But now, over the last several years, we've seen all these, with Occupy and as you said, with the Black Lives Matter and against police brutality, a lot of young folks in particular coming out of the woodworks. The difference is they didn't vote as much as the white America that felt that they were disrespected during the Obama administration did.
Yeah, and only time will tell. And I guess I want to pivot here as our last 10 minutes of the show here on the Friday. And only because it's a Friday do I have to bring this up. Somehow George W. Bush, the 43rd president of the United States, is making the media rounds this week despite ending his second term with an approval rating of mere 22% and using his opposition to gay marriage to propel his reelection campaign. The former president appeared on the Ellen DeGeneres show. Ellen, what are you doing? Well, it's the Jimmy Kimmel show. Garland, what are we doing bringing George W. Bush back into the fold And what does this say about our collective nostalgia towards former politicians in the United States?
A couple of things. And, you know, absence makes the heart grow fond. So, you know, it's been the history that
another 8 years maybe hearts can fully grow fond, I
guess. President's been
gone
for a while, you know, seems a little bit nicer. The other thing is this. It shows this, that the current president is so outrageous that he makes George Bush look good.
Bush was like, wow.
Right now,
yeah.
Bush looked like, at least he wasn't completely nuts. He may have, you know, screwed everything up that he touched, but at least he wasn't like a deplorable human being. Yet and still, I think, you know, I question the Ellen DeGeneres and of the world and those people who bring a guy on like him and they lend legitimacy to what I consider an extreme. I considered his administration with Dick Cheney an extremist administration, particularly with what they did in Iraq in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, it's wrong to lend legitimacy to what these people did and what they started that we're still dealing with today.
Jamal, how many George W. Bush oil paintings have you already purchased?
Well, let's put it this way. I have not forgotten what he's done. So it's none. And I find it ironic, just like what Garland was saying, that Trump is such a circus and such a screw up that we're actually like forgiving Bush for all that has happened. And you know, it does say something about the fact that, you know, 8 years later, he can go on these different shows as if they didn't invade Iraq and as if 9/11 didn't happen and as if we haven't lost all these soldiers' lives. That was completely unnecessary, and as if they did find weapons of mass destruction, which they didn't. You know, I had a situation a couple of years ago where we were coming from the National Press Building for a conference on black media, and in the lobby, out comes of the elevator is Colin Powell. And a couple of my friends, I'm not going to say their names, but one of them in particular is like, should I knock him out now? And we were like, no. But he says, but you know how many lives, you know, we lost because of him and Bush and that whole administration. And it was like, yeah, but still you can't knock him out because I need you. But the fact that we understood what happened because of their decisions, to me, it's just unforgivable. And it's something that we're trivializing right now. And I was watching the news where they were showing him on the Ellen show and they're laughing and joking. I'm like, yeah, I don't like this dude.
I hear you. Garland Nixon getting in there.
Here's another. So let me take an alternate perspective also. You know, we have yet to see what Donald Trump's military foreign policy will look like. But here's one thing we know about his domestic policy. It's identical to that of George Bush. Let me end up by saying this. Grover Norquist, Paul Ryan, about a year or two, for the last several years, they've been saying the only thing we need in a Republican president is someone with working digits that can handle a pen. The fact of the matter is the outrageous policies that we're seeing from Donald Trump right now were all written long before Donald Trump became president. We are seeing Donald Trump enact the policies that an extremist Republican Party had written up for years. These are the policies of George Bush. We just don't know what the military foreign policy will, but these are exactly the policies.
Yeah, and all the people that say, you know what, America's had enough of the foreign military invention. They're not going to go back to the Middle East. It's one, we're already there. We're already bombing seven different countries. Yeah. We dropped 20,000 bombs last year. And we're letting the guy George W. Bush back on our late show. So what is that signaling to you that America is tired of war? But we could stay on George W. Bush all day, but let him do more media rounds. The last story I want to get to with our final few minutes that we have remaining here on Friday. For those of you who don't remember and those who may not be American football fans, Colin Kaepernick, the soon-to-be ex-San Francisco 49ers quarterback, made headlines last season after he refused to stand during the playing of the national anthem before the start of the football games. Instead, Kaepernick would kneel during the anthem in order to draw attention to the ongoing injustices people of color face in the United States. While his action led to other players in small numbers following suit, many people, including the media, collectively lost their mind and called for Colin Kaepernick to be kicked out of the NFL or something much worse. Now, Kaepernick is a free agent, allowing him to join any team he'd like. However, he has issued a statement telling all potential teams that if they sign him, that he will no longer kneel during the anthem, but instead now stand. Jamal, we just have about a minute left. Is Kaepernick selling out here to give himself the best chance of keeping his job, Or has he done enough via his actions and large money donations to the Black Lives Matter movement that he can argue that, hey, I got to look out for myself and my own paycheck if I'm going to feed my family and be able to do any of the activism work that I'm being loved for?
No, I don't think he's selling out. I think he made his point, and it was extremely effective, and a lot of people were offended, and he needed to be offended in order to get their attention, and he did what was necessary. He woke up a lot of people about the national anthem. He woke up a lot of people about the injustices of racism, and in particular with police brutality in America, and he used his position as an athlete, you know, to the utmost, and I'm fine with him doing this. If he wants to stand now, he can do that. It's his choice. He did his job, and he donated a lot of money. He actually got $2 million to go because he donated $1 million, and the 49ers backed it up and doubled, you know, backed up with another $1 million himself. So I don't have a problem with him doing this.
Garland,
let me reflect my Zen discipline. When you cross a river in a boat, when you get to the other shore, you leave the boat there. You don't have to take it up and carry it with you. He's made his point. He doesn't need to keep doing it.
Mad props to Colin Kaepernick. Big thanks to Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon Fridays on WPFW. Check it out online. Along with Jamal Muhammad, a.k.a. DJ One Love, who is on Love Lounge on We Act Radio. Also, can check that out online. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at By Any Means Necessary. I was your guest host, Bob Schlaber. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.